You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
It is ook een avond waarbij Nederland.
It's an evening where the Netherlands, after Brexit and the American elections, said stop to the wrong kind of populism.
But is there a right kind of populism? The Netherlands doesn't seem altogether certain. My guests Quentin Peel and Tom Rivers will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including yet another initiative aimed at countering terrorism and extremism in Europe, and Donald Trump's plans for the US budget.
Do I think we can cut spending and get waste out of government? Absolutely. Where and how and what numbers? That's something we'll be figuring out as time goes on.
Speaker Paul Ryan clears the way. Soft power does not appear to be a priority. And we'll learn about the Beyoncé preferences of Irish parliamentarians. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow with the Europe Programme at Chatham House, and Tom Rivers, London Correspondent for ABC News Radio. Welcome both. And we will begin in the Netherlands, whose parliamentary election yesterday has prompted cautious sighs of relief across Europe, or at least those portions of Europe possessed of sufficient historical perspective to understand where eruptions of populist nativism can take a continent. The anti-immigration insurgency of cranky xenophobia Geert Wilders did slightly less well than widely dreaded, and centrist Liberal Prime Minister Mark Rutte seems set to continue in office. Quentin, first of all, we've seen statements praising the Dutch for being good, responsible European citizens from the likes of François Hollande, Merkel and Rajoy. Are they all being a little bit premature in their celebrations?
Well, I think they're relieved, certainly, and I think they're justified in being relieved. Incidentally, we've also seen a certain cloud of comments on social media from the Trumpites and the Brexiters saying, oh, how rotten, you know, they're really actually quite depressed that Geert Wilders didn't come top. Now, having said that, it was a very interesting election. It does show the fragmentation of Dutch politics.
Dutch politics has always been fragmented.
Yeah, 28 parties, it's an awful lot. I think that there are some very interesting trends out there. So the centre-left, which is pro-European, pro-immigration, very tolerant, has come through quite strongly. And Geert Wilders just didn't do anything like as well as he did. So I think we may be seeing the high watermark of populism.
Tom, though, is this actually an outright repudiation of Geert Wilders? He didn't do that badly. He still came second. He polled 20 seats. He's not completely written off.
He's not written off. He said, I was once leading a party that came in third. He says, this is second. His words, the next election we're pushing for number one. And as Quentin says, I think it is a high watermark at this stage, this snapshot in time. But I think if we have another, say, an economic event of, say, 2008 around the corner, that anger is still there. And interesting as well, you said, Quentin, you know, in American politics, you always see a swing, a pendulum swing, and the natural, if you will, point is in the center. And I think the modeling, look at the polling. The modeling was wrong here. The modeling was wrong in America. The modeling was wrong as far as polling in the Netherlands. And I think we've got to redefine this because we're seeing the Greens increase. We're seeing Wilders not as well as he thought, but he's there. It's significant. So we've got to find a new way of trying to actually project and determine where these elections are going.
I mean, on the subject of a reversion to the centre ground, Quentin, is there something in what seems an extraordinarily high turnout, 80.2%? Is this basically people who in a different year with different stakes might not have bothered sort of bestirring themselves to go out and try and thwart the extremists?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think that there are two factors out there. I mean, I think that there were people who genuinely didn't like what Geert Wilders stood for. And I think there were also people people who said, we don't like the idea that we might be the next domino to fall. We have seen Brexit happen in Britain. We have seen Donald Trump come to power in America. And actually, that's not what we want to happen here. I think we've actually, because we saw Wilders' figures dropping ever since Donald Trump took over
that's
the
true.
Oval Office.
I mean, is that a possibility, do you think, Tom, that unwillingness, as Quentin puts it, to be the next domino, the idea that people can now see what happens when the populist insurgency in a given liberal democracy actually triumphs? And so, I mean, granted that the French may turn out next month and make mugs of this theory,
right.
It wouldn't be the first time they've done that, but is it possible that a plurality of Dutch voters are now looking at post-Brexit Britain and are looking at Trump's America and thinking, actually, this probably isn't all that much fun in real life?
You know, some may be saying that, but I think they'd be wise to say, you know, what shape and form and what's Brexit going to look like 2 years down the road? Nobody in this country knows. Nobody in the Netherlands knows either. So, I think this is a work in motion. This is not the finality. It is a high watermark today. It may not be the high watermark 2-3 years down the road.
And there are an awful lot of factors that can play out. I mean, in the Netherlands, actually, the Erdogan-Turkey factor probably helped Mark Rutte and his party.
Rutte, of course, made quite a point of standing up to Erdogan.
Stood up, you know. Turkish ministers wanted to come and address big rallies literally 2 or 3 days before election day. And it was a totally, if you like, provocative gesture by Erdogan, mm-hmm. who wanted to stir up a big nationalist theme back home. So Rutte stands up to him and saw him off. But having said that, I was talking in Berlin a couple of months ago about their elections later this year, and they said our elections could be decided by Erdogan, because the very same Turkish president, if he takes his restrictions mm-hmm. off the flood of refugees coming to Europe, and suddenly we see another flood this summer, that could knock Angela Merkel in Germany sideways.
Tom, what have you made of the foreign press coverage of the Dutch election, which has obviously had far more attention mm-hmm. than Dutch elections usually get?
Exactly.
And there is only one reason for that, which is Geert Wilders. Has the press overcovered him? Have they just sort of, I mean, he's obviously an important figure and he represents something that is interesting and should be covered. But have the media fallen into that trap of just realizing that cranky extremists are frankly great box office? So let's put him on TV again and again and again and again.
If you want to be crass, he would have been a great story if he had won. An amazing story. And you're absolutely right. Do we cover elections in the Netherlands every election cycle? No. But we were interested this time around. A lot of the other broadcasters were, as well as newspapers. So it's a different animal this time. And you're right. It plays into this nice theme. Is it the domino that does fall or does not fall? And everybody's going to be looking at the end of April to France. And then, as you said, Quentin, in Germany in September.
Okay, well, let's move along slightly now, though staying in Europe. And while it is encouraging that large numbers of Dutch voters did recognise Geert Wilders' prophecies of the Islamic conquest of Europe for the paranoid fantasies they are, this does not mean that Europe does not have a problem with radical Islam. And no countries need to be told about this less than France and Germany, which is why the interior ministries of the two now plan to work together to create a European centre to combat radicalisation. Quentin, is there an element of something must be done-ism here? What do we know about the specifics of what they're actually planning?
Very little, and my heart sinks. I mean, I think last people in the world who really will be good at setting up a sort of de-radicalisation unit are a couple of interior ministries, and actually then trying to bridge their own cultural divide, if you like, to come up with a single answer. I just fear that it is exactly what you say, the something must be done feeling. And I mean, I would be delighted to be proved wrong. But this whole de-radicalization exercise is not something that big bureaucracies can do. It's a very difficult and subtle game that requires engagement right down on the ground in schools mm-hmm. and basically in the communities that are being radicalized. And we've seen some radical gestures just even in the last day. This is not about Muslims. This is about kids going a bit cracky in schools.
Well, they have been quite careful, I think, to specify that it is just extremism rather than just Islamist extremism, although obviously Islamist extremism is the proximate worry of the moment. The incident you referred to today in Grasse, where several people appear to have been wounded, but police are describing... And this, I'll ask you this, Tom, because this is a thing that I keep wondering myself every time another one of these stories occurs. The police are describing the suspect as, quote, an unstable individual fascinated by guns. But the thing is, aren't they always? Because whenever you delve into the personal history of any Islamist terrorist, the pattern repeats itself with incredible predictability. They tend to be young men, not terribly smart, no particular sort of prospects of employment, and usually a fairly prolific history of drug use.
Drug use and oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes some jail time as well. It's a difficult one because, I mean, today, for instance, in the newsroom, we saw this breaking and it was, do I show up here tonight or is it going to be something big? Turned out to be relatively small story. But you're right, that there have been for countless years crazy young men out there, predominantly, that will do these things, and it isn't always in the name of terrorism. So these things carry on. These things.
But fortunately, we don't have so many guns in Europe.
True.
That we have these mass school killings. But I mean, I remember there was the case last summer of a young German-Iranian boy who went slightly berserk in a shopping center in Munich, and slightly berserk. I think he killed half a dozen young people. Mm-hmm. It turned out that this was all about being bullied in school and he was obsessed by it. It had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that he was Iranian. But that hasn't stopped that event being repeated again and again and again as an example of a sort of Muslim extremist crime.
But this is what I wonder, and this is my own doubtless extremely flawed potted theory, that when we think about, especially if they're thinking about it in terms of Islamist extremism, all it really is the present-day contemporary mutation of an age-old problem, which is that, you know, young men in general, and I can remember being one, do sort of tend towards... They're attracted by kind of romantic and violent causes, and a small cohort of them are unbalanced, crazy, or just unpleasant enough to act on it. It has always been the case.
But back, I'm a little bit older than you, Andrew. And back in my day, I only had magazines or books to look at.
True.
And now these young men can see endless, very violent things in video, and you almost always find that's what they've been looking at. So that does worry me, because I think there is a whole area out there that we still don't know how to contain or control.
Tom, is there also, I guess, a lack of historical perspective in, I guess, especially in the way these things are covered? It's treated as if this is an entirely new phenomenon which has descended on us from nowhere. And again, the 21st century nihilist jihadi is kind of new, but terrorism in Europe has existed as long as there has been Europe.
Yeah, well, we can go back. I mean, there was terrorism from the left in places like Greece. Go back to the days of Germany, and we had all of the problems there as well. Look at some of the attacks in this country going back to the 70s, etc. So yeah, it has been around, but this is a new form. And as Quentin says, this is something absolutely. If you check the background of the truck attacker in Nice, maybe the truck attacker in Berlin, all of these people have, A, they were unstable, but two, you can find they have a record of having clicked on the internet and the self-radicalization element, in addition to who knows what other personal influences there might have been, is certainly a component right now.
How do they get around, Quentin, the very fact that they are unmistakably agents of the government and the state that presumably these people think they're rebelling against?
I don't think they can, but maybe they can set up programs where they do find people who are much more subtle and much more in touch, because otherwise I think it's going to be clunky, it's going to be obvious, and the kids are just going to say, hey, we don't want to have anything to do with you.
Tom, they are talking about trying to enlist the people who were themselves once radicals and have since thought better of it. Is that a way forward?
I think that's the only way you're going to get to these kids, because I think it's going to be unwieldy, it's going to be too large, it will not dovetail with the domestic programs in each country. But you're absolutely right. If you have some individuals that can go out and say, I used to be a member of this, I did that, and don't do what I did, I think that is a message that might very well resonate.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Quentin Peel and Tom Rivers. Coming up next, what will President Donald Trump prioritize in his first budget? Spoiler alert, it's probably bad news for performance sculptors.
New decade, new monocle. No biggie. After 10 years of doing it like that, we're now doing it like this. A refresh, a redesign, showing a bit of editorial leg. So, we'll meet the huddle behind the controversial hard man, President Duterte of the Philippines. We'll meet the people that decide what you'll watch next at Netflix. We'll investigate the boom industry, the business of sleep, and we'll wonder what we can learn from architecture designed with animals in mind. And there's a hound on the cover just so we could have a story about dogs with jobs. The headline, The Dog's Barracks. Monocle issue 101. Out now.
Can you smell that popcorn? Well, while you're waiting in line, let me tell you about some of the standout guests we've spoken to recently on The Cinema Show. This year's Palme d'Or winner Ken Loach told us how going back to basics was integral to the strength of his winning film, I, Daniel Blake.
Paul wrote two characters which have quite simple, straightforward situations.
Fellow Palme d'Or winners Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne told us how reaching the heights of the film industry can have its downside.
Because after Cannes, the reactions were mixed. Some good, some less good.
And Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan gave me a glimpse into his creative process.
What matters in making movies is all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity.
So now you've heard the trailer, all you need is the main attraction. Tune in to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 every Friday at 20:00 in London. Or download the podcast now. You'd better hurry with that popcorn though. The movie's about to start.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Quentin Peel and Tom Rivers. Now, President Donald Trump is preparing to interrupt his busy schedule of playing golf and pulling wires out of the walls long enough to present his first budget to Congress. It's likely to prove good news for people who own shares in defense contractors and bad news for almost everybody else. Funding will be slashed for the State Department, the Department of Education and the Environmental Protection Agency, and abolished altogether for the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities, the Institute of Museum and Library Services, among other propagators of fancy pants, highfalutin book learning. Tom, he does have to get all this by Congress, of course. So to what extent is what he is floating now symbolic of the kind of presidency he hopes to enact?
Well, it is a real eye-opener for a lot of people out there. And as he said on the campaign trail, he said, look, there's something like 56,000 bridges across America that need some kind of work on them right now.
Well, that's true enough.
And he's not even talking about that. He's talking about defense. And if you look at the footage every day, we've left a lot of pieces of equipment out there in places like Iraq and elsewhere. And again, that's a huge, huge increase there. He's cutting back on the soft, if you will, diplomacy, State Department. That is a big, that's a huge cut, 28%. If you want to say, well, we can cut, who knows, 5% of whatever fat is there, fair enough, maybe, but 28 is going to be a real, real hit. It's going to be tough.
Quentin, he seems to have learnt the wrong lesson from a much-cited 2013 quote by the now Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, that if you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition. So what Trump appears to be doing is not funding the State Department fully and buying James Mattis more ammunition. I don't think that was the point Mattis was trying to make.
Just the opposite.
Correct.
Nonetheless. Hey, I like the touch. I mean, it is. He is pouring money into defence at a time when, to be fair, I think everybody says that sort of defence kit is not relevant to today's world. We're fighting much more subtle, difficult wars, you know, on internet and so on.
Exactly.
But I mean, spending a load of money now on nuclear weapons, I thought we'd moved beyond that. So it is $54 billion more on defence.
$54 billion, and I looked this up. That increase is bigger than the entire defence spending of all but four other countries.
Yeah, there you go.
Just that increase.
Well, I mean, before this, Andrew, I think it was, what, the US spent more on defence than the next 10, 11, or maybe 12 countries. That's before this increase. So this is an incredible, incredible blow.
Well, I know what they're saying in Germany, for example, where they are being expected to double their defence spending, and they say, we don't know what we can spend it on. And that's peanuts compared with what he's doing.
Well, I think
doing.
They bought some, what did they buy a couple of months ago? They said they ordered some new air transport, which is useful in a number of different regions, and some submarines. I don't know what Germany's going to do with a bunch of submarines, but they're going to buy some.
But Tom, how is this still politically sellable in the United States? Because it's absurd. I mean, it is by an order of magnitude the most powerful nation that has ever lived. The idea that it is military threatened is ludicrous, self-evidently. I'm not any sort of pacifist peacenik who thinks that the United States should not be a powerful country. But this idea that people manage to sell over and over again, not just Trump, that that the United States is weak and it is vulnerable. Who still buys this?
It's a large, if you will, group of people who don't have passports in America, and their worldview is a little bit shorter than people who bounce around the planet. So yes, that's who's listening to this and nodding their heads right now.
What do you make of the things he's axing, Quentin? Because it does look to me, at least, like he's gone through the entire United States federal budget and just drawn a line through the things in which he is personally uninterested.
Well, right up there, clearly climate change. Everything to do with climate change he appears to be axing. He's axing poverty programs. As Tom was saying, he's axing dramatically the diplomatic and aid budget. So anything to do with soft diplomacy and anything to do with climate change is just getting clobbered. So we are really, I mean, the scary thing about President Donald J. Trump is that we're getting exactly what he wrote on the tin.
I do wonder how many of the people voted for him did make the not uncommon assumption, in fairness, that, you know, that he was just doing sort of showbiz on the campaign trail, and once in office he'd calm down a bit and it would be a fairly normal Republican administration. It hasn't been. We have learned today in the last, just while we've been on air in fact, I'm laughing because it's better than any other response. The Senate Intelligence Committee, which is chaired, of course, by a Republican, Richard Burr, has officially made a statement that there are, quote, absolutely no indications that Trump Tower was under surveillance by the U.S. government before or after the election. So what we have here is, and just to reiterate, this is the Senate Intelligence Committee basically saying that the President of the United States is just plain making things up.
Well, came out, and we were talking about this earlier. It was either yesterday or a bit of an earlier today, but he said he has some information which he says he'll release within the next 2 weeks.
Looking
so we wait for that. We wait for that, Andrew, and to see exactly what that information, because it's going out on a heck of a limb if you're making these kinds of accusations.
Do you think it was something like, do you remember that wonderful case of the American embassy in Moscow, where they built a whole new embassy in Moscow, and then they discovered that the KGB had got it riddled with bugs, and they had to knock the whole thing down?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's still 3 years and 10 months of this to go. Just a quick final thought on this one from you, Quentin. Can this be sustained? I mean, this is an absurd situation. These are not partisan opponents of the president. This is the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by a Republican senator, saying basically that the president of the United States has accused his predecessor of committing a felony, and has no evidence for this claim whatsoever.
As a logical man, I do not believe it can be sustained. I do not actually believe that President Trump will last a full term. But logic has been thrown out the window in the last year.
Okay, well, finally tonight, the combination of a bored journalist and the internet usually results in little more than arguments on social media. However, one hack at Irish entertainment publication The Daily Edge made rather more of a slow afternoon by contacting every member of Ireland's parliament and asking them whether or not they liked Beyoncé, and if so, for their favourite song. 37 of 158 Teach de Dála, and apologies there for the pronunciation, replied, often surprisingly passionately and knowledgeably, none more so than 61-year-old Foreign Minister Charlie Flanagan, who recalled seeing her play live in New York and was unable to limit himself to fewer than three favourite tracks. Tom Rivers, first of all, what's your favourite Beyoncé song?
I don't have one. To me, it's Wallpaper. It's nice music, but I'm not the person to
A few
to
TDs
ask.
Did reply much to that effect, yeah? In fairness. Quentin, do you have any firmly held views on the subject?
2 hours ago, I could not have named a single Beyoncé track. But I've done my homework.
Good man.
And I didn't like any of them.
What, you've listened to her entire catalogue in 2 hours?
No, I've listened to about four or five songs. And I thought she's a very pretty woman, and she can sing a bit, and I'm sure she's hugely popular. It just showed me how terribly sad and old I am that I couldn't even name one track.
Well, there's a quote for the posters for her next tour, certainly. But there is a wider question. I mean, I really enjoyed the story. It was just a brilliant idea for a colour piece. The politicians responded much in the spirit in which it was intended. It's terrific and very, very funny. But is this, do we learn anything from the musical preferences of politicians? Is it the kind of thing that's worth knowing?
That's an interesting thing. When you're younger and you're dating and you kind of go, we used to go through the records, right, of whoever you're going out with, and that music could tell you something about that person. So maybe we can up the ante and say, I wonder if this character or that one over there, what their musical background is, and maybe it lines up with mine. And
Tom, isn't it? It's a bit sad. I bet they've got public relations people choosing which one they're supposed to like.
Some do, and some can really surprise you. I interviewed Jeff Hoon when he was Secretary of State for Defense, and this was when he was fighting a war on two fronts, and I went to interview him for a brief color piece for another magazine. We ended up spending 2 hours discussing the solo works of Ryan Adams, the merits of the latest Jayhawks album. He was turned into like a massive indie rock sado and really knew his stuff.
Amazing.
Because he initially could see I was being somewhat skeptical and thought that I was...
I would have never thought that from Jeff.
There you go.
I wouldn't,
that
exactly.
It
made him a better defense minister.
But are you skeptical of this whole line of inquiry, Quentin? Do you not think we learn anything? Would it alter your opinion of a politician on discovering that they happen to share your tastes?
Well, the truth is that I love listening to that BBC programme, if I dare mention it, Desert Island Discs, when you do sort of get a feel for a person out of what their favourite music is. And you tell stories around that. So, hey, that's nice. And I'm very proud of the fact that in 1966, I was at the Newport Folk Festival and I heard Arlo Guthrie sing Alice's Restaurant for the very first time.
I thought you were about to tell us it was you that shouted Judas at Bob Dylan. That was at the Hammersmith Odeon. If memory serves. Quentin Peel and Tom Rivers, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. This is all we have time for. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. The Daily has more on the main stories at 2200. And I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.